So, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Welcome to day two of the exciting ventures we're going to be talking about from the Lotus Sutra. As Kate mentioned yesterday, the Lotus Sutra has, you know, a number of stories. So I thought I'd start off with the story. And my story is going to be how I first met the Lotus Sutra. And it happened a few years ago. I was in my late 20s. And it was a rather strange experience, actually, this first encounter with the Lotus Sutra. My late 20s, I only knew the word Lotus Sutra. I'd heard it before because I had studied a little bit about Buddhism. But I had recently graduated from UBC and had a scholarship, went to Japan. And a Canadian friend of mine who had gone to Japan a year earlier had made friends with a couple that owned a bar in Tokyo. And she introduced me to them, and we talked, and this couple turned out to be members of a Buddhist organization. And when they heard that I was interested in Japanese religion, they were all excited. And they said, well, why don't you come to the next gathering that we're going to have at the temple? So I thought, sounds okay. And so the next week we went. The temple was quite interesting to me. It was partly old, probably 100 years old or more. And also, though, it had a very new and a very expensive looking extension on it. And that's where the meeting was held. And about 50 people or so gathered there. And there was a priest. There was a kind of a lot of chanting and something that I assumed was a sermon going on at some point. I didn't speak much Japanese at this point, although I had studied it, didn't really understand that much of it. And then afterwards, after the service had finished and the sermon was over, my friend and I were invited into this private room. And we went in, sat down, and the priest came in, who had officiated at this place, and sat down. And he looked rather splendid in these gold brocade kind of robes. Very different from what we wear in the Zen tradition. Quite striking. I remember thinking, whoa. And after a little bit of introductory conversation, who are you, where do you come from, and you speak such good Japanese, which when you live in Japan as a foreigner, you always get told how good you speak, even though you hardly speak it at all. Thank you. And then suddenly his demeanor became quite fearsome. He changed, quite amazing. And he almost demanded that we accept the Lotus Sutra. We should be chanting the title of the Lotus Sutra in Japanese, and we should join the organization. I didn't really understand all that he said. I didn't understand that much of what he said. But the tone was certainly like a kind of hellfire fundamentalist preacher. And I had never, ever met a Japanese person like him. And after about 20 minutes of this harangue, which I guess was all the time he had to give us, he had better things to do, he relented and said, well, I hope you guys will at least read the Lotus Sutra, chant the title, and come back. And of course, we never went back again. But later, I wondered what was in this Lotus Sutra that would bring forth such kind of wholehearted commitment and such a robust, shall we say, teaching style in that priest. Because although he was really off-putting, that whole approach was very off-putting, as I'm sure you can imagine, his compassion and kind of sense of urgency in telling us something about this Lotus Sutra and the hope that we would embrace it, all of that was very clear, right? He was very sincere. And then later on, you know, as I lived in Japan and learned more about Japanese religions, I learned that this kind of, you know, fire and brimstone approach was pretty commonly used in that particular school, that particular stream of Buddhism. So that's encounter number one. And then a few years later, for classes that I was doing there, I had to, you know, I read part of the Lotus Sutra again and found it kind of strange and befuddling. Because I was used to having read some of the early Buddhist texts from the Pali Canon, very clear and kind of rational, and some of the Zen texts, which were not rational, but pretty clear. You kind of understood it. And nothing I had read was really as grand or as imaginative as the Lotus Sutra. And the other thing about the Lotus Sutra, which I'm sure you'll encounter and we'll talk probably more about as we go through these classes, it never really gets to the point. It's always talking about the Lotus Sutra, but never kind of says what it is. So at any rate, I was not impressed. And then the third encounter, later, much later, Kate and I were preparing for ordination with our teacher, Dzogchen Norman Fisher, and he asked that we read the Lotus Sutra as part of our preparation. Well, I must confess, I never read the whole thing at that point. I had still hadn't read the whole thing, right? Three attempts, anyway. But I read part of it. But this time, my response was different, or the result was different. And it became clear to me that the Lotus Sutra is really using kind of very powerful and different ways of teaching the Dharma. And it really emphasizes the positive and the joyous. The positive and the joyous. And that's something that's a little bit rare in Zen texts particularly. You don't often get like great joy and people all excited and happy. It's more like you get cracked on the head or something like that. Anyway, so I came to understand that the Lotus Sutra was like a play or like a movie or like a story or novel, kind of appealing to a very different part of us, you know, than the usual texts do, appealing to our creativity, our vision, our imagination, and maybe more than anything, our sense of wonder, you know, bringing us maybe into a childlike place. And in doing so, I think if we're open to it, can kind of push us a little bit beyond our everyday assumption of what the world is and about what our lives are, which generally is not full of joy and bubbly and excitement, right? Often we're kind of, at least I am, a little bit more on the dark side. So I'm really enjoying this chance to approach the Lotus Sutra again and study it together with all of you. So today I thought I'm going to be focusing on something called skillful means, one of the main teachings of the Lotus Sutra. But before I do that, I want to just say a couple of words that, you know, inside the Lotus Sutra, although it never really gets to the point, it does have quite a few very important teachings. And I think one of the most important themes that kind of bind this collection of texts, really, because it's almost like a collection of texts rather than just one, is a theme of unity and integration, how things are unified, how things integrate together. And there's many ways, when I look at the Lotus Sutra, like how it really applies this theme of how things are integrated and put together. And skillful means, or expedient means sometimes as it's translated, is one of those. And it's telling us this is one way to deepen your practice and to open up and towards the world as it really is. And this is really important for us, living as we do today, in a place and a time where we love to kind of put things in ranks or hierarchies, the kind of place everything from university to restaurants to movies to dog breeds in a kind of order, right? This is the best. This is not so good. Don't even bother with that. You know, we have this kind of constant putting ourselves, as well as everything else around us, in some kind of rank, right? And usually that rank is not like, this is the yellow group, this is the blue group, this is the red. No, it's more like, you know, like, this is good, this is not so good, this is awful. So we constantly make these kind of lists, and as a result, our modern life often seems to me to be a kind of endless picking and choosing. And with that endless picking and choosing, I mean, look, you go into like Save on Foods and you want to buy some toilet paper? How many kinds and types of toilet paper are you, do you have to like go through? You know, are you going to get the 2-ply or the 3-ply, the extra soft, the one with powder, the one that's recycled, the one that's made of bamboo instead of paper? On and on it goes. And sure, choice is great, but I think that there's also an underlying anxiety that we may not make the best choice. And so, you know, you see people reading the cans, right? You know, like checking. You know, of course you want to know what's in it, but it's like all our life is like that. This is how we are. This is how we are. And of course, in this picking and choosing, which is not only toilet paper, but almost every other aspect of our lives and how we judge and think of other people there too, we don't all agree on what's the best or what's the better choice. And this is nothing new, of course. This is part of our human condition. Certainly, even during the time of the Buddha, I mean, right after he died, very soon after he died, there arose various schools. I guess they weren't quite schools right after he died, but soon evolved into separate schools and sects, you know, about what the Buddha taught. So that by the time the Lotus Sutta was written, which was 400 years or more after the Buddha died, after that time that the Lotus Sutta was written was a time when the monastics and the scholars would be debating about what's the best way to practice and what's the most accurate teaching of the Buddha. Which tradition should we follow? Which school is the correct one? Which one's the incorrect one? Just like we do today, the scholars and monastics struggled to find the best way to live, the best way to practice. Right? But maybe rather than falling into that, we need to first ask, is there a best way to practice? Is there a best school? Maybe we're not looking at this quite right. That's a foreshadowing of something the Lotus Sutra is going to tell us. So, as Kate mentioned yesterday, the Lotus Sutra begins with a great assembly of tens of thousands of followers of monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, and a host of other worthies and beings from other realms. Who are really cool, by the way. If you look up what all those other creatures were that were gathered, and many of them are kind of like they're considered to be guardians of the Dharma, but just really cool. And if you go to Japan, you get to see some of them in statue form. Okay, so they're all gathered. They're here. Buddha's going to teach, and he does. And there's beautiful kind of grandiose description of this, or at least setting the scene, right? And then the second chapter of the Lotus Sutra, which is called Skillful Means or Expedient Means, the Buddha rises from this state of deep meditation and he says to Shariputra, who is traditionally one of the foremost disciples of the Buddha, considered to be very wise. He says, the Buddha says, the wisdom of the Buddhas is infinitely profound and immeasurably The wisdom of the Buddhas is infinitely profound and immeasurable. The door to this wisdom is difficult to understand and difficult to enter. Not one of the voice hearers or Pratika Buddhas is able to comprehend it. And as Kate mentioned yesterday, voice hearers refers to those who hear the teachings of the Buddha. And it generally means his immediate disciples, the monks and nuns. Right? And in a more general way, it's kind of people who follow the Theravadan tradition, the early teachings of the Buddha, in a more general sense. And the Pratika Buddha is one person who has awakened through his or her own efforts and generally doesn't make an effort to help other people awaken. So this might be like a hermit, you know, off in the mountains, you know, practicing by herself, or a recluse somewhere in a cave, you know, doing all the practices and studying more or less by himself. So in other words, though, going back to the quote, the Buddha is saying in here, nobody understands it yet, the real truth. No one understands the Buddha wisdom. And perhaps implying that those voice hearers, the people who, you know, were studying the early, and the people who go off and live in caves and huts, that their understanding is partial and incomplete. Well, you can imagine the effect that would have on all of these people who have gathered around to hear him, and most of them are voice hearers, right? People who listened to him before, and they're going, wait a minute, what's he saying here? And then, a little bit later, the Buddha adds in the Lotus Sutra, Shariputra, ever since I attained Buddhahood and have through various causes and various similes widely expounded my teaching and have used countless expedient means to guide living beings and cause them to renounce their attachments, I have done this. And why? Because the Tathagata, meaning the Buddha, is fully possessed of both expedient means and the paramita of wisdom. So he's implying, I've used all these devices to teach, just to guide people along. But no one's really got it yet. Right? So, amongst the great assembly of the monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen, there was great consternation. What did the Buddha mean with this talk of expedient means? What did he mean that no one comprehends the wisdom of the Buddhas? Do you ever have that feeling? Like, I've been doing this practice for years? And and what did it mean about their own practice and their own understanding? Well, as Kate also mentioned yesterday, that, you know, these guys and women there all had a kind of telepathy, right? Today we have to rely on texting each other, but in those days it was pretty fast. So Shariputra, sensing this consternation, asked the Buddha to clarify the matter. And Shariputra says, "World Honor One, what causes and conditions lead you to earnestly praise expedient means, the foremost device of the Buddhas, the profound, subtle, and wonderful law that is difficult to understand? From past times, I have never heard this kind of preaching from a Buddha." So, and then Shariputra has to ask this three times. Please explain what you're talking about. Please explain what you're talking about. Because that was the custom, to demonstrate your sincerity, you would ask three times. Which actually, you know, when I first went to Japan, that was true in Japan too. Like, you know, if someone invited you into their house or something, you would always say a polite excuse until they've asked three times. Certainly, you'd never pick it up on the first time, right? They say, why don't you come over for lunch? You go, yeah, sure. They go, that would be not the couth. That would be terrible. So you got to, you know, because people are being polite, and you got to be polite, and you play this little dance, right? Which all makes sense if you know the rules. Okay, so Shariputra asked three times, the Buddha refuses twice, giving the reasons that his answer would confuse people. But fortunately for us, the third time that he's asked, he agrees to teach the Dharma about this. And at this point, a very famous scene occurs in the Lotus Sutra. At this point, 5,000 monks, nuns, lay people who think they have already attained full wisdom and have nothing else to learn, stand up and leave. Can you imagine that? 5,000 people, right, at this great assembly, which is tens of thousands, they stand up, well, heard this one already, let's go. Starbucks. Kick back a little. We'll come back when he gets to something else. And the Buddha doesn't stop them. But afterwards, after they leave, he makes this comment. Now this assembly of mine is free of branches and leaves, made up solely of steadfast and the truthful. Right? So he's saying, well, branches and leaves, which I guess is a simile for the, you know, kind of the unsteadfast. And I find this really interesting. That even when the Buddha spoke, there were those who were not ready or able to listen. Here at Mountain Rain, Kate and I give a lot of orientations to practice. Right? Recently, it's almost every time, it seems, there's new people come, which is wonderful. Yes, September, that's true. And then quite a few of these new people come, you know, once or twice, and then we never see them again. And I wonder, was it me? The practice, the formalities, the atmosphere, you know, just kind of wondering. And then there are, you know, those people also who have practiced for, you know, maybe several years and then suddenly stop coming. And I suppose there are, of course, many reasons, many causes. In fact, recently I read a comment by a famous Korean teacher who was asked why some people seem to stop practicing after they've practiced for quite a while, and they just suddenly stop coming to the Zendo. And he said tersely, "Not enough suffering yet. Not enough suffering yet." And perhaps that's the case sometimes. Thich Nhat Hanh, in his commentary on the Lotus Sutra, wrote, "Whatever eyes you use to look at the Buddha, you will see the Buddha only through those eyes. If you're driven by craving and look at others through those eyes, everyone you see will be full of craving also." So he's writing that, you know, we're limited by our vision and understanding. But as he comments also, the Buddha is much greater than our vision and understanding. So here perhaps the reluctance of the Buddha to speak is also perhaps a kind of skillful means. He's holding back because he realizes it may be too much for his listeners to receive and then to put this teaching into practice. And he waits until they go. But there's another aspect to this passage which I think is really important for us to consider. And that's the recognizing that our own experience and understanding is limited. And that we should strive to be open and inquisitive. Especially when we feel challenged by a particular teaching or a view, that we should not, you know, kind of reject it out of hand or dismiss it. But kind of question it from our own situation. And by that I mean things like asking ourselves, you know, how does it fit with what I know or experience? How does it fit? Or how does it not fit? How does it challenge me? Like, you know, oh, I think that's a load of hooey, but there's some emotional aspect to it. How is that challenging me, challenging my view of how things are? And is it useful? Or should I just disregard it for now? Did I say for now? like not just send it to the recycle place right away, but wait, you know, perhaps maybe this, I need to come back and just check this. Because in rejecting out of hand, we may just be walking out on the Buddha. So, once the assembly is free of the branches and leaves, the Buddha begins to teach. And he says, Shariputra, the Buddhas preached the Dharma in accordance with what is appropriate, but the meaning is difficult to understand. What is this? Because we employ countless expedient means, discussing causes and conditions and using words of simile and parable to expound the teachings, this Dharma is not something that can be understood through pondering or analysis. Only those who are Buddhas can understand it. Only a Buddha, and later on we'll see in the classes, of course, in the Lotus Sutra, that Buddha means much more than just the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, that we know. So what he's telling us here is that the teachings that we study and pick up, hear from others, are not a description of the ultimate nature of things. But they're a means, a way, to bring everyone, monk, nun, man, woman, child, everyone, closer to the realization of their true nature. The text goes on to illustrate this by using the example of the doctrine of achieving personal nirvana, you know, like we're striving to achieve nirvana, as also a kind of skillful means to lead people to a practice that eventually goes beyond nirvana. Nirvana is like the carrot, I guess. It's the carrot, the candy, right? The cheesecake that you get at the end. But then we go beyond. Go beyond to attain, as the text says, wisdom embracing all species. Wisdom embracing all species. Wisdom, I think, that goes far beyond any notion that we have of ourself. The Buddha says, within the Buddha lands of the 10 directions, everywhere, right? The 10 directions, everywhere. There is the Dharma of only one vehicle. There are not two, there are not yet three, save where the Buddha, preaching by resort to expedience and by merely borrowing provisional names and words, draws beings to him. I love that expression, draws beings to him. In the Lotus Sutra, they talk about one vehicle, that all the myriad teachings that we have are basically expedient means, drawing all beings to him, meaning drawing all beings, you know, to their Buddha nature, to that which we all share and are connected with. And this is the purpose of the teachings and of the Buddha. As it goes on in the text, the Buddha talking, he says, all the things they, meaning Buddhas, all the things Buddhas do are done at all times for one purpose. They wish to show Buddha wisdom to all living beings and enlighten them to it. The Buddhas, the world honored ones, appear in the world because they want living beings to open a way to the Buddha's insight and thus become pure and awake. They appear in the world because they want to demonstrate the Buddha's insight to living beings. They appear in the world because they want living beings to apprehend things with the Buddha's insight. They appear in the world because they want living beings to enter into the way of the Buddha's insight. This alone is the one great cause, Shariputra, for which all Buddhas appear in the world. And a little bit later, one more short passage. He says, you should have no doubt, Shariputra, or the whole assembly, you should have no doubt. Your hearts should be filled with great joy, for you know that you too will become Buddhas. I find these two passages and the teachings there very, very inspiring, because there have been times in my life when I have ruminated on my past, thinking, if only I had done this or that, or if only I had continued to do this or that, right? I gave up too soon, or if only I had stopped doing this or that. And sometimes it's rather depressing to consider all the places and times where I went wrong. And perhaps, though, wrongness or lack or badness has nothing to do with it. Perhaps it's just more a simple growing, a kind of maturation that's just needed to occur because of all the different causes and conditions in our lives. You cannot force an apple or a pear tree to bear fruit until it's reached a certain maturity. The fruit will only come with certain and the proper causes, conditions, and with time. But the Lotus Sutra, the message here, is very clear. We will all get there. One way or another, we will all get there. Many ways, many different people, just hang on. To illustrate this message of kind of, you know, the many ways, this kind of unity and yet diversity, or unity within diversity, the very next chapter of the Lotus Sutra, see, we're moving along here, we've gone through. it presents us with perhaps its most famous parable of all, the parable of the burning house. You've heard this one before? The parable of the burning house, perhaps? The parable goes like this. A rich man returns home to find his very large and very rambling house, which is in quite a bit of disrepair, it's on fire. And there's only one narrow gate leading in and out of the house. But to his horror, when he looks inside, he sees his children are inside this house, oblivious to the fire and engrossed in their games. And so the father naturally calls out to them, you know, urging them to get out of this burning house as fast as they can. But they ignore his warnings because they're playing their Nintendo game and they're totally into it. And they just continue playing. And he frantically considers what to do. And he wonders at first if he could run in and gather them all up in his arms or carry them all out on some kind of bench. But there is only one narrow gateway in and out of his house. And he realizes that it's too narrow and that those plans that he's formulating in his mind just won't work. So the father calls out to his children again, but this time telling them that he has brought back wonderful toys for them. And the text says, a goat-drawn cart, a deer-drawn cart, and an ox-drawn cart. Now, wouldn't that make you want to run out of the burning house? Have some fun? Boy, I'd be out of there. And so the children rush out. to see these wonderful new toys, much to the great joy of the father, of course. He's rescued them. And when they ask him, as children, of course, will do when they get out there and there's nothing there, where the carts are, he goes and he buys and presents each of them with a very large and fancy carriage drawn by a white ox. And the children, of course, are delighted. And then the Buddha then, having told this parable to Shariputra, then explains the simile. That, it's pretty obvious, but hey. Like the father in the story, the Buddha, in order to save everyone from the fires of dukkha, from the fires of our self-clinging, our sorrow, old age, grief, lamentation, despair, uses skillful means to encourage all of us to awaken from our delusion and realize our true nature. Now, this skillful means is not new. New at the time of the Lotus Sutra. It's a Sanskrit word. The Sanskrit term is upaya. And we certainly see examples of this in the early Buddhist texts. For example, when the Buddha awoke, had his awakening experience under the Bodhi tree, he was very reluctant to teach at first, according to the text, right? He was like, you know, this is very subtle, it's very difficult to understand, it's taken me, you know, 6 long years of tremendous practice to get to this point, and no one's going to understand me if I try to explain it to them. But fortunately for us, a deity appears to the Buddha and encourages him to teach for the sake of others. For those who are caught in sorrow and overcome by the pains of birth and old age and death. And according to the text, the Buddha opens his cosmic vision and he saw that there are some people in this world who have, as the texts say, a little dust in their eyes, along with people who have much dust in their eyes. Those with very keen faculties and those with dull faculties. And some that will be easy to teach and some that will be very difficult to teach. And with this vision, his compassion arises, karuna. He's very stirred, and he makes a resolve to stay in the world and to teach the Dharma to all who request. But now, of course, he's faced with a very daunting task of teaching and rendering the Dharma accessible to everyone, of creating a strategy that would accommodate those who are very quick and those who are very slow. And his solution was to use skillful means. In the early texts, it's pretty clear that skillful means in the time of the Buddha was like we teach gradually, right? Start simple and kind of work up to more complex or more challenging instructions. But in the Lotus Sutra, we see that kind of idea of skillful means gets expanded quite a bit. And the Lotus Sutra gives some details and some challenges of what it's like to try use this skillful means. In the Lotus Sutra, both through the use of parables, like the burning house, and also through direct teaching, we can see that the skillful actions and skillful teachings are really practical. They're meant to do something. Skillful means are practical. They're meant to turn us towards a beneficial outcome. Deepen our understanding, letting go of clinging, opening our hearts in some way. And it's also clear from the teachings that the motivation for skillful means is bodhicitta, that kind of great compassion that's arisen, just as the Buddha arose, this compassion for helping others. That skillful means arises from compassion. So in other words, you're not trying to manipulate somebody to get, you know, you're not nice to somebody so that they'll do something for you. It's coming from this, you see suffering, and naturally you reach out just as the mother or father picks up their crying child. Bodhicitta, this heart of wisdom, this great compassion. And I think just naturally arises. Kathy Fisher, who is the wife of our teacher, Norman Fisher. Kathy Fisher is a secondary school teacher. And
junior high.
Oh, junior high? Junior high. And she once said to us that when she faces a particularly challenging and recalcitrant student, she asks herself, what can I give him? What can I give her? Because sometimes words are called for, sometimes actions are called for. But I found that very moving, a very simple, you know, when you're facing someone who's like in your face or someone who's pushing your buttons or someone you would want to deal with in a little more forceful way, to ask, what can I give him? What can I give her? I'm working on this. So that's one quality of skillful means, that arising from this bodhicitta, from this compassion for others. And practical, right? It's to help them to some beneficial outcome. And skillful means are also effective. They work. But that doesn't mean they work right away, or that you'll get it right the first try. Because we know, example, in the burning house, and we see this in other parables in the Lotus Sutra, first of all, the fathers think, oh, I'll run in and I'll grab them and I'll haul them out. And then he has to rethink that, because that's not going to work. And we see other parables in the Lotus Sutra too, where a person tries something that doesn't work. So failing is part of skillful means, just as persistence is. You fail and you keep going. Just recently, Pema Chodron, the American Tibetan teacher, teaches Tibetan Buddhism. She gave a commencement address to the 2014 graduates of Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. And she began her commencement address with a quote from Samuel Beckett that goes, fail, try again, fail again, then fail better. We don't know what will be skillful means until we courageously try it. We use, of course, our knowledge and experience that we have, and we try to act and speak in a skillful way. But there is no guarantee of the outcome. But we keep on trying. We keep on trying. I think skillful means are also very creative. We can't rely on what was effective in the past. We can try it, but it may not work. There's a kind of dynamic quality to skillful means, I think, that really comes forward when we're fully present in the situation, when we're just there, using our practice to hold us grounded. The Jan Chosen Bays, a Zen teacher in Oregon that Kate and I have practiced with, she said to me once, you need to have a well-equipped tool belt with various tools of practice. Right? You can't rely on one practice, right? You need a good tool belt. But you also need to be resourceful. Have lots of tools, that's great and that's very important, but then you also need to be resourceful. Maybe there would be no tool that will be useful at that point. And still you have to go forward. Still you have to offer. So we enter a situation with our tools of practice, our presence, and a kind of openness to the unknown. I don't know. Will this be effective or not? I don't know. But we're open to receiving, to giving, and allowing to arise whatever will arise. Suzuki Roshi, I think, really encapsulated this really well. He called this beginner's mind. And he clarified this by saying, you know, in the beginner's mind, there's many possibilities. But in the expert's mind, there are few. So this is not knowing quality that we bring forward with skillful means. It's nice to read about skillful means in the Lotus Sutra. But we then need to ask, what relevance does this have for me? What relevance does this have for us today? Well, I think one, of course, is that we should try emulate the qualities that I've just mentioned that embody the skillful means. This bodhicitta, the compassion, persistence, keep trying, just fail better next time. Just keep trying. And an openness. That not knowing, but being willing to be present. But there's one more. One more kind of challenging and salient point that is woven throughout the Lotus Sutra. In the Lotus Sutra, the truth or fundamental doctrine or description of absolute reality is never given. It never tells us what is the absolute truth, what is the absolute reality. It's not spoken about. Skillful means is a vehicle for expressing truth appropriate to the person, time, and place. We've already talked about that. But according to the Lotus Sutra, all the Buddhist teachings are none other than skillful means. As it says in the Lotus Sutra, though one should seek diligently in the 10 directions, he will find no other vehicles except when the Buddha preaches them as expedient means. Everything is expedient means. They are all appropriate, these teachings. They're all effective and they're endless in variety. With this understanding, we can hold our own views and criticisms about practice and Dharma with a kind of lightness, a kind of gentleness. It's not that our views and criticisms and our ideas about it are unimportant, but if they weigh us down, if we hold on to them, we can't move beyond. We can't move beyond them. The Lotus Sutra refers to itself as a skillful means, teaching us that there is no single method, no single doctrine, no single truth to hold on to. It describes the compassionate teachings and activities of countless Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Without reducing any of these teachings or activities to a simple formula, or a fixed doctrine, or a final teaching, this is really important. This is really important. Even in the early teachings of the Pali Canon, the Buddha described his teachings as a raft or ferry to take people across. And that once we've crossed these troubled waters of dukkha, once we've kind of dealt with this, there's no need to hang on to the raft. We can put the raft down. The teachings are provisional. Or we could say, the teachings are like flowing water, constantly there, nourishing and in changing. So during this practice period, let's together take encouragement from the Lotus Sutra as we continue on this path. And also practice the fine art of not getting caught up in our notions of what the truth is, or how things should be, or how my life should be. And when we're noticing that we are holding on to a view of how life is, let's just smile and try to loosen our grip a little. Maybe by asking, what else is here? What else is here? Well, I think I've maybe gone over time a little bit. Thank you so much for listening. And I look forward to continuing to study and work together with you in the Lotus Sutra.
May our intention deeply extend to every